Hello and welcome to episode 13 of the Alternative Kitchen Garden. I'm Emma and today's show is very special. It's going to be a bit of an extra length episode because earlier in the week I was lucky enough to visit somewhere I've always wanted to go, the Risk Roof Garden in Reading. Now before we leap straight in with the garden tour, Dave Richards, the garden coordinator, is going to tell us a little bit about the Risk organisation and why the garden was built.
Risk is an educational charity. The aim is to raise awareness about global issues. For us, the garden is a perfect opportunity to raise awareness, particularly around sustainable development, and also making the links between what happens locally and what happens globally. So anything that we can do to make our gardening more sustainable, of reducing the CO2 impact of our own gardening, will have benefits for not only ourselves but also communities in other parts of the world who will be adversely affected by global warming. But also we see the garden as a tool for raising awareness of all kinds of aspects of more sustainable living, and it's been designed specifically to do that, because we feel that a garden is like an outdoor classroom, and it can be used in all kinds of ways to really enrich the experience of kids. That you can very sort of in a very dry way sort of look at things like food or nutrition, but when you're actually growing things yourself and then eating them, that just adds a whole new dimension. So the garden is a tool for that, as well as being a nice place for our centre. And it also solved several problems, because when we moved here, we had very limited funds. And in common with most flat roofs, it was a long struggle with a bucket of bitumen and a big brush sort of trying to find the holes. And eventually we put together a funding bid to the lottery. And part of us getting that was making the project much more interesting than just renewing some roofing felt.
Yeah.
You know, whole concept of a roof garden with an educational purpose.
That was back
also
in
helps. So that was 2002.
2002.
Yeah. Well, 2001 was when we actually did the funding bid. It came through and planting started in 2002. So what you can see here is in its fifth year, and we started with not particularly large mature plantings. It's all grown very well and thrived on just the foot of soil. The design follows permaculture principles, and the idea is to use the maximum potential of the site. And so for us, there was no other land available, and so it had to go on the roof. And luckily for us, it then also solved the problem of a leaking roof. And created a whole new resource, as well as then providing insulation for a large part of the centre. It provided a way in which we could harvest rainwater. It provides sound insulation, because one of the areas is used for gigs and is quite noisy, so it performs that function as well. And then also provides a way of minimising waste from our cafe and the rest of the building. So we compost all the vegetable waste from the cafe, paper towels from the loos, shredded paper from the office, and then it's a two-way process, so that the cafe uses cut flowers, cut plants for table decorations, and then herbs for cooking and that kind of stuff. And so from that kind of point of view, it just explains to ordinary people some very kind of simple things which they could incorporate into their own gardens to reduce environmental impact.
And now we're going to move outside, and Dave is going to take us around the garden and show us some of his favourite plants. Now, this was an outside broadcast, and it's an urban area, and it was very windy, so there's a bit of noise in the background. Hopefully that's not going to put you off.
The whole thing was designed on permaculture principles. At that time, we didn't have enough confidence to actually do the whole thing ourselves. So we had the idea as a kind of vision, and then we scoped that with a local permaculture designer called Paul Barney. He came up with ideas, and we sort of threw them around. Basically, he came up with the planting, and the idea was to choose plants which showed how important plants were in our lives, that even though we lead very synthetic sort of existences, and our kind of plastic iPods and whatever, silicon and whatever else, that actually we still rely on things which grow in the soil. And that's a really, really important thing to convey to everybody, but particularly to young kids. I think it's a right of kids to get their hands dirty, get soil in the fingernails. We've had lots of wildlife here. We've had goldfinches, we've had a sparrowhawk taking out a local pigeon. People get very excited about the black red start in terms of green roofs. They're losing their habitat of waste ground.
Right.
And so developers are being encouraged to incorporate, you know, what's called brown roofs, rubble. You know, that would you would
and
find
on a waste. Right.
Yeah, and let it kind of seed itself and it provides a perfect habitat for black red starts. But I think unfortunately our habitat is much too rich for a black red start. We got lots of butterflies and all kinds of other flying bugs. And luckily not too many snails.
I was gonna ask you about that. Do you have the same sort of pest problems, a couple of stories up, that people would have in their gardens at home?
No, I'm not sure whether snails and slugs suffer from vertigo. But
they don't come up here.
Our main pest is because we're in a kind of an old city centre location is rats. So you'll notice that we've kind of got various rat traps around, and the rat man comes out occasionally. And we even had we have salsa classes in some of the meeting rooms below. And one night they had a visit from two rats who fell through the skylight. But we've incorporated a green cone composter.
I've saw
which
that,
you can
yeah.
see over there, which is claimed to be rat proof. The green cone works really well, and you know, we definitely recommend it if you've got, you know, a small family and just chuck everything, you don't have to empty it. It's a kind of a no hassle way of composting.
Do you move it around?
No, stays
it
where
just
it
stays
is,
there forever.
Yeah, and then it feeds the bed. And what we do is plant other things, particularly say comfrey or the nettles. So any kind of spare nutrients help to
Sucked
feed
up.
Those up, and then we cut the comfrey and then spread that around. So, you know, it's another way of just making a kind of a fertility patch based on the composter. Our selection of plants shows how important they are. So most have multiple uses.
Uh-huh.
For example, something like we've got a golden hop growing over there. People know about how it's used to flavour beer, but also makes a really, really nice pillow. So you take the female flowers, you put it in a pillowcase, and it helps you get to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And then the vines can be used in basketry. You know, that's at least three uses.
And it uses up a sort of vertical space, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
So it doesn't take up any room.
That's right. And is also, you know, very pretty. Can become a bit of a weed. Does sort of entertain our senses. It's lovely smell.
Well, that's a use in itself, isn't
yeah,
it?
Absolutely. And then another interesting one is Hemerocallis. So you know, most people have daylilies as an ornamental, not realising that in the Incas used it as a source of carbohydrates.
Have you tried eating them?
No. Flower is really nice.
Yeah?
The flower is really, really
flower.
Sweet. Yes. So, and as a way of really impressing your dinner guests, as a way of garnishing your salad.
Looks impressive.
It's perfect. Yeah. And it does taste good. It was the roots which were used as a source of carbohydrates by the Incas, so they would harvest the tubers. And then the leaves were used to weave espadrilles. Another multi-purpose plant.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, multiple use plants, but then also to illustrate the importance of plants to history. It's just another way in which we can embed different stories in the garden,
mm-hmm.
you know, just remembering that kind of educational purpose. For example, we've got some Emma wheat, which is very, very ancient wheat, very, very close to the wild grass.
Uh-huh.
And archaeologists have found traces of the grain in Neolithic sites 23,000 years old in Israel. It was basically the source of carbohydrates that sustained Western civilization. The Celts brought it to Britain 6,000 years ago, and it brought Julius Caesar to Britain because, you know, he wanted to feed the Roman Empire. Be something which, you know, kids grow in their own gardens. You know, it just provides another take on history and the importance of plants. Yeah, you know, we've also in the greenhouse we've got some tea. The whole story of colonialism is intimately bound up with, you know, the quest for profits from plants, whether it's sugar or cotton or tobacco. So again, you know, it's another dimension that really brings these kind of stories alive. That was another element in our choice of plants, the whole geographical spread. So, you know, there's probably most corners of the globe are represented here, although there's a preponderance of stuff from China and North America, because
okay.
it's, you know, places that have similar kind of climates to ours. Because the whole kind of edible forest, agroforestry kind of movement is beginning to take off as people see its potential.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, you know, with global warming, particularly with shortages of water, it is a way of, you know, making your plot more productive conserving soil through use of ground, permanent ground cover, use of perennials. And so, you know, it ticks all those boxes. So a lot of the research which is going on now in developing kind of temperate agroforestry techniques, you know, is looking to how well plants do from similar kind of climates. And there's some really, really interesting, quite exotic stuff. So we've got several varieties of kiwi plant here. It's both some self-fertile ones and also ones which rely on boys and girls to do their business. And several Chinese climbers as well. There's a really nice example of a Stauntonia over there, which you're lucky because it's actually in flower now. And so that one really is multi-purpose because it is rampant. It's evergreen, doesn't mind the shade, beautiful, beautiful leaves, gorgeous smelling flowers, smell a bit like jasmine, and also produces edible fruit. I mean,
oh wow, what would you ask for?
Yeah, absolutely, and then also has vines which you can use in basketry, so you know, what more could you ask of a plant? And then we've also got a chocolate vine, a Kiwi cunata, which is another Chinese one, which is also rampant, beautiful flowers, fruit, and in China is used as a contraceptive.
You need a brave volunteer to try that one out, wouldn't you?
Yeah. It's all still quite new, it's still quite cutting edge, kind of exploring this kind of way of planting. From our point of view, it's really challenging and exciting and pioneering in a way.
You'd never guess standing here that you're two stories up or whatever.
No.
What's this big tree that's reaching for the sky here?
Well, that's our version of the canopy layer. That's a self-fertile cherry, that's Stella.
Oh, right.
That's a good 15 feet,
and
we've had to lock the top off, so that just shows
that's very
you.
Very impressive, because considering the root depth.
On a foot
got.
Of soil, that's really good.
Very impressive. Do the birds eat the cherries?
Yes, it's a struggle to get there before.
I was going to have problems netting that.
Yeah, no, that's the main problem. The local population of blackbirds looks very fat and sleek. On all the berries produced here. But we get enough, particularly, I mean, we have quite a few school visits, and they're probably worse than the birds. Schools are being asked to, you know, develop a more healthy living element in the curriculum, and, you know, what better than that of having a garden?
Absolutely.
And, you know, because nowadays, you know, kids get a piece of fresh fruit a day.
Oh, really?
So, you know, you get all these kind of imported apples and oranges. Mm. And how much better to have stuff which the school itself has produced. And, you know, for so many schools, the school grounds are a problem. You know,
yes.
That they, you know, the bursar has to find a contractor who's going to come in and mow the grass and come in with a strimmer and hack up all the shrubs,
yeah.
You know, which are just ornamental. And so it's, you know, basically it's a problem. Whereas, you know, for us, if they're managed properly, you've got a design which really maximises its potential in an educational sense, then, you know, it's a real resource. And what's interesting is that the government is actually, the Department for Education and Science is actually saying that schools should be a beacon to the whole community, that on top of SATs and everything else, you know, schools are being asked to provide an education for the wider public in terms of waste minimisation and reducing energy and that kind of stuff. And for us, you know, a garden is a good way of doing that. You know, you could have demonstration composting in school gardens so that, you know, when parents go to pick up their kids, you know, they can see it being done. You know, little examples of solar energy, renewable energy, that kind of thing. It's exciting times.
Do you have a favourite plant? It's possibly a difficult question looking at this oasis.
One or two. We push to say just one. This is the spiny pepper plant. So it's from Asia.
Oh, it is spiny, isn't it?
It is. It's lethal. So if you want to keep vandals out of your garden, that's a good way. Just if you just crush that and smell it.
Oh, wow. That's very strong, isn't it?
It certainly clears the nostrils, doesn't it? And it produces little red peppercorns. In the autumn, and that's one of the ingredients of Chinese five spice. If you infuse the peppercorns in olive oil or something like that, then it gives your salad dressing a bit of a kick.
Mm, I bet.
And then also, if you chew the peppercorns, then it makes your gums numb, which is why it's called the toothache chew.
Ah, toothache chew.
So it serves as a clove, but, you know, you can grow it in this country. You don't have to go to the Far East or the Caribbean to get your cloves. You can grow them in your toothache plant in your own garden.
This one, it looks quite healthy. It's just going a bit rampant, isn't it?
Yes. It's already had one haircut, and it probably needs another one fairly soon.
Is pruning this a popular job?
No, you're disposing of the...
Those mature spines at the back there, I didn't see those. They look awful.
Yeah, no.
Very spiny.
Inflict serious... Yeah, so harvesting the peppercorns is a bit of a problem. Yeah.
Fantastic.
So that's one.
That's
favourite.
One of them, yeah.
And the other one is down the other end of the garden. It's Orkney Molinae, so it's Chilean guava. Very easy to propagate from cutting. Comes from South America. It's a part of the myrtle family. Mm-hmm. It's a good hedging plant. Also produces the most fantastically tasty berries. So they're a bit like a blueberry, but a kind of a taste of kind of strawberry, very subtle. It was much loved by Queen Victoria. It used to be grown commercially in the West Country, and she'd have a basket of them sent up on the train up to the palace. It's a bit like a box hedge, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It looks like one of those things that you'd walk past it without knowing that it was going to do anything edible.
But it's only in October that it comes into its own.
Oh, really?
So people who visit the garden in October get an additional treat.
I bet they do.
Yeah. Oh, the medlar. So we've got a medlar over here. So that's another October. That's another reason to come in October. So we've got these gorgeous, great big blossoms at the moment.
They're enormous, yeah.
They're beautiful. So it's Mespilus germanica. So originally comes from the Caucasus, and then made its way across to Western Europe, and the Greeks knew it. The Emperor Charlemagne liked the fruit so much that he decreed that all imperial gardens should have them.
But you don't eat them straight off the tree, do you?
No. It's a really interesting. I think it's an old English word called bletting. So basically, you let it rot on the tree, get really, really ripe on the tree until sometime in October, and then you take it off and then you store it on straw and let it rot even more. So it's almost fermenting. And so it's a process called bletting, and you can scoop out this most delicious flesh. It's like eating spiced fruit, and it doesn't need any sugar. It's really, really great. And we found old recipes for medlar sorbet and medlar pie.
Wow.
But because it's a bit of a hassle to process, so obviously it doesn't have any kind of commercial use.
No.
Although a Capability Brown really liked it because it has a quite a bent over gnarled
it does, doesn't it?
Growth to it.
Very interesting growth pattern. Yeah. Yeah.
So you know, it appeals to the kind of romantic in those gardeners. It's definitely something, if my garden was just a little bit bigger and wasn't competing with all kinds of other fruit, then I'd definitely have one. Yeah.
How big does it grow?
A bit bigger than that. One of the effects of growing in a foot of soil on the roof is the kind of a dwarfing, it's kind of bonsai effect. Yeah, I mean, it could grow to 3 or 4 metres quite comfortably.
So not a small tree.
No, but what's nice here, what's particularly suitable here, is that there's quite a lot of space underneath for underplanting.
Yes.
It's quite a useful plant for the forest garden, where you're trying to get as much diversity as possible. So, this garden is 30 metres by 6 metres, so it's the size of a good size allotment.
Mm.
And we've got over 160 different varieties of plant here. And as I say, you know, something... for most of the year. So now, you know, we're in early May. Over there we've got some Good King Henry. So that's a plant which is now, I mean, whatever its origins, is pretty well a native, often found in hedgerows. And that was used particularly by poor people as a way of supplementing the diet, because it can be used like spinach.
Mm-hmm.
And also the seed head can be, the seeds can be ground up into an edible paste. We've also got one of Ray Mears' favourites, it's a pignut.
I don't know about pignuts.
You don't? No.
Yeah.
So it's also pretty well a native, and it grows in the forest floor. Has this gorgeous sort of feathery foliage,
yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah. And then lovely flowers, it's umbellifer. So it has these white umbels. And then under the ground in the autumn you get these tiny little nodules,
uh-huh,
which are very nutty, a bit chestnutty, which are very I mean, you don't get much for your money.
No.
But it is tasty. And I believe that for Native Americans, that's what they taught the Pilgrim Fathers to harvest when they were
hungry.
And in danger of dying out. Then we've got a few berries here. They tend not to do very well on the roof, I think, particularly in the, you know, because of the drought. despite our water harvesting system, which we've got here, and the irrigation system, we've got a drip irrigation system. So the berries really do struggle. But you can see there that we've got some lovage, which is a really nice, herb, which goes really well with potato soup. What else?
Is that lemon balm?
That's lemon balm, yes. Lots of lemon balm. That's very good for the brain.
Really?
Yes, so we tell kids that if they want to help themselves pass their exams, then they should
drink
make lemon balm tea. Yeah.
Do you have trouble with that one? Because it self-soothes like crazy, doesn't it?
Yes. We've got over there an edible honeysuckle.
Oh.
Which is quite interesting. I mean, you wouldn't go out of your way to eat the berries.
It's not yummy, but
No. Yeah. A lot of the the kind of edible fruit is more stuff for cooking, so good for pies. There's American chokeberry, which the name doesn't sound very encouraging, but it's actually really good for pies and also good for jam making because it's very high in pectin, so it helps the jam solidify. So also now this time of year, the wild garlic is out, and so a good time for nettle soup. Absolutely delicious and very, very nutritious as well. So. But you really do need to get the nettles, very, very young. And also you can just see over there the Solomon seal. That's gone past its best, but when that's just about 6 inches high, the little shoots, they can be harvested like asparagus. Really, really nice. So just lightly braised with a bit of butter. A real treat. There's a number of toxic plants up here,
right?
And we, for us, it's really important that you know kids realise that you can eat lots and lots, but you really do need to be told. You know, you can't just eat anything; you've got to be told.
Mm.
So that is the red kind of rhubarb stems.
Oh yeah,
that's American pokeweed, Phyllolacca americana. So that comes from the US. And is seriously toxic.
Right.
So both the leaves and the berries, which are a bit like an elderberry, undermine the immune system so that can kill you. But Native Americans would take the berries and would crush them into a paste and then dry it in the sun, and that neutralises the toxin. And so with processing, it's a bit like cassava. You know, cassava's lethal as well, yet it's the part of a staple diet in South America.
You don't need a special licence to have poisonous plants.
No, you just have to promise not to feed people the berries without drying them out first. And also the leaves are also toxic as well. But
again,
in the States, they're processed, they're bored a few times and that neutralises the toxins, and it's canned and sold as pokeweed salad. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously worth it. And what's interesting is it's very much part of our culture. Elvis Presley fans will remember that he did a song called Pokeweed Annie about a poor white girl who ate pokeweed salad. And that was number one in the US charts in 1969.
A little bit before my time.
Yeah. But when Neil Armstrong was walking on the moon, it was number one.
Oh, wow.
And then the other interesting thing is that, well, pharmaceutical companies are doing a lot of research on it at the moment as a possible cure for HIV/AIDS.
Oh, right.
Because, you know, like with a lot of alternative medicines, you know, what in too large a quantity can kill you, in smaller quantities can have a beneficial effect. So, for example, there's also another thing over there called Indian physic. Beautiful, beautiful form to the flower. This one here, quite nice shaped leaf, a bit like a chestnut leaf. And that piece, beautiful white flowers, which are the sort of shape of a human person.
Oh.
So it's like a bit star-shaped. That basically makes you chunder from both ends. It's used in Indian Ayurvedic medicine as a purgative. So sometimes when you want to clear out the system, then the judicious application of the plant is beneficial. This is a self-fertile kiwi. So this is very smooth leaves.
Right.
This one is dioecious.
Yeah.
So it needs males and females.
Uh-huh.
So they've both produced flowers so far, but they haven't done the business yet.
Right.
So we're still hopeful. But really rampant growth, isn't it?
Absolutely,
lovely leaves. Tropical.
They're huge, aren't they?
Jungle.
And slightly furry.
Yeah. And these are another, I mean, despite the name, they're not from New Zealand, they're from China.
China.
Chinese gooseberry is another common name. And these are actually a lot tastier. These hardier ones are a lot tastier than what we get in the supermarkets.
Oh.
You know, the furry ones.
The fruits are smaller, aren't they?
Yeah.
So it's more
sort of
concentrated flavour.
Yeah. And again, because, you know, a climber using space which, you know, is otherwise unused, getting productivity out of every square inch from, you know, a small suburban garden, it's ideal.
I've heard if you can get them to fruit, then you'll be like giving away kiwi fruits by the barrel.
Yeah. We're still waiting for that.
Still waiting.
Yeah.
Ever hopeful.
And then here you can see this wall I'm standing on is another example of how in our hard landscaping we're trying to, you know, to recycle or to reuse and or renewables. Mm-hmm. So Oxfordshire limestone that was originally used in Reading Abbey, because when Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries, Reading Abbey was basically used as a quarry. So when our building was being built and refurbished in the 17th, 18th century, then a lot of the abbey was used in its fabric. And when we were renovating the building, we turned up a lot of it and we've used it in various places. We've also, all the hurdles along the side are made from locally coppiced hazel. Mm-hmm. So that's another example of, you know, a locally produced renewable material. The decking was made from local windblown oak, which has been milled on a small mobile mill, which actually goes into the woodland. Over here, we've got on the chimney over there, we've got a small wind turbine. Oh. And a solar array above the greenhouse.
Quite a big solar array. Yeah,
it's very, very old technology. We inherited it from a local environment centre which closed down. It's not that efficient, but it still produces enough energy to power our irrigation system, our drip feed irrigation system. So all the water which falls on the roof and the surrounding roofs falls down to this corner, and there we've got a 2,000 litre tank, and then water's pumped around at night to reduce the evaporation. But unfortunately, I mean, you know, when it doesn't rain for 6 weeks, and no matter how big your water butt, it's not enough. And then here you can see this is kind of a low-tech drip feed irrigation system where we've got a bucket which you can fill with harvested rainwater. And then there's a bit of porous pipe which goes out into the bed. So it's just using gravity to feed an irrigation system. And this is something which is being used increasingly in developing countries as kind of, you know, low-tech, low-cost.
Efficient.
And that's the emmer wheat over there that you can see just growing there.
It does look like wheat, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's quite, I mean, when it's mature, you'll notice the difference, because it's hairy. It's got quite long whiskers, and modern wheats have that removed, because obviously you don't want to spend some precious fertiliser and water growing whiskers. And it's a hulled wheat. So like the early wheat was hulled. It meant that each seed was individually encased within a hard shell.
Right.
So that the processing involves sort of bashing each of those seeds to get rid of the hull, and then you would have to separate the chaff.
Mm, so
processing was hard work. Mm. Yeah. And so the modern varieties of wheat, the modern Durham wheat, you only need to separate the seed off from the seed head, and it's much easier, which is why it became popular. But what's interesting is that emmer wheat is still found in places like in Ethiopia, where it's used to make beer. And there's a new niche market. So in Italy, the specialist organic pastas are made from emmer wheat. So, you know, because of its flavour. Mm. So, you know, it does have a niche market. Oh, this is interesting. Here we've got ochre. So this is Oxalis tuberosa, which comes from South America. So it's a similar kind of area as the potato. And you can see it's got that kind of oxalis kind of leaf, that kind of cloverish leaf.
Yes.
If you went to a marketplace in South America, you'd see these laid out like spuds. And you can see very small tuber. But they generally grow a bit bigger than that. Really tasty, very lemony flavour. And they're doing a lot more research now to see if they can increase productivity, because it doesn't suffer from blight. Unlike potatoes. So, you know, potentially a good source of carbohydrates.
It'll be interesting to see whether that catches on.
Yeah, yeah. It's nice. It's nice raw. Mm-hmm. It's got that lemony flavour, but also you lightly boil it, and it's also really tasty. And then we've got the strawberry tea. The fruit look like strawberries. Same size as strawberries. They don't taste like anything like strawberries. Birds love them. Some children like them, but most people find them a bit sort of gritty and grainy. Mm. But interesting, and beautiful, kind of cinnamony, sort of coloured bark, and it's evergreen as well. But I mean, you know, it has its purpose. Mm-hmm. It's quite good as a kind of sculptural plant, and then is good for wildlife and looks nice.
Absolutely.
Can you see now it's got these kind of fresh shoots, really sort of lovely.
Lovely.
Fresh green.
Acidy green colour.
Yeah. And then we've got some angelica over there. Uh-huh. Sort of older people remember candied angelica uses cake decoration.
Is this chard, self-seeded itself there.
Yeah, it's basically growing on gravel. This is an interesting one. This is sea kale.
Oh.
Cranby maritima.
Very trendy.
Is it?
Yeah.
All right, yeah. But it's also very, very good to eat. So it's very close to the wild cabbage, so it doesn't suffer from diseases so much.
Mm.
And then it's still grown commercially in France, where a bit like rhubarb, you would force it so that it produces the very delicate white shoots.
And it's quite popular on allotments where people have got space for unusual things. But as you say, it doesn't really suffer from pests and diseases, so it's quite an easy one to get going.
Yeah, and it's quite easy to propagate as well from root cuttings. This is over there, Inula. So again, most people think it's just a big, large leafed sort of daisy flower. But actually, it was in traditional medicine, herbal medicine, it's used as a cough mixture and as a cure for TB. And then comfrey, the organic gardener's kind of staple plant, was another one. Poultice made from ground up comfrey was used to knit bones, broken bones, and mend bruises and all kinds of things. And travellers, gypsies, used to feed it to their horses before market.
I bet,
because it brings up the sheen in a coat. And
it's
so
got
gets
quite
a
high
good
protein
price.
Content,
But there's fears that it might be carcinogenic for humans, so
the advice is not to eat it.
I've been told that comfrey fritters are cooked in the
batter. Deep fry most things. It improves a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah. Here we've got smell that one. Sage. It's pineapple sage. And makes a nice relaxing tea.
Oh.
A bit like the lemon balm which we're surrounded by as well.
Yeah, it smells really lovely.
So no, that's good. Originally comes from Mexico, so it's sort of fairly marginal here. Dies right back in the winter.
Mm.
But one of the effects of having the garden on top of the roof is that it does create a microclimate. So it's a bit like having the luxury of an underheated garden.
Absolutely.
So things do come on early.
It's quite enclosed, so you don't have too many problems with frost, I wouldn't imagine.
No. And along this side, you can see we've got all our cordoned fruit on the south-facing side of the garden. That doesn't tend to last very long. Kids just can't resist picking them before they're ripe.
Ooh. It must be lovely having something like this to come to every day.
It is. As I say, it's the being at that kind of pioneering stage, and it's also sort of trying to evangelise not only about green roofs, because it really does tick so many boxes in terms of solutions for urban planning problems.
Mm.
Yeah, because if you just particularly the phenomenon of turning every space into a building or a car park, and then on top of that, people putting this block paving in their front gardens, just our landscapes, urban landscapes, are increasingly impervious, and where does all that water go? It goes into the Victorian drains that weren't designed for that amount of water. So, and what's interesting is that in some countries, green roofs are the norm, and that developers are encouraged or sometimes even forced to incorporate some kind of system for coping with a surge of stormwater. So, as an alternative to having a huge surge reservoir under your building, if you had a intensively planted green roof like this, then 80-90% of the water which falls on your building is actually absorbed and retained in the landscape and is used, and also it helps to cool the landscape, because increasingly towns are becoming hotter and hotter, and it's called the heat island effect.
Mm.
So with global warming, it's ironic, you've got buildings getting warmer, people using more energy to cool them down with air conditioning, and so CO2 so a green roof like this is an antidote to that. If you're doing a new build, why not create this whole amenity value?
I was going to say, looking at this, I can't imagine why anybody wouldn't want this.
No.
If you walked out every morning and saw this, it'd be fabulous.
Hmm. But just in terms of productivity, imagine that if your staff of your building, had an oasis like this to come to during their lunch hours.
Mm.
How productivity would increase. And I mean, there's lots of evidence, particularly say in hospitals, that people's recovery rates improve when they've got sight of a tree.
You've had people who are interested in having allotments on top of, you know, blocks of flats and that kind of stuff. And I know Ken Livingston in London is really keen and is promoting green roofs. People don't realise that Canary Wharf, a lot of the buildings there have brown roofs before the Black Red start, or extensive green roofs, so like sedum roofs, intensively planted green roofs. Although obviously the start-up costs are higher than, you know, an ordinary sedum mat, you know, you do need to have some kind of input from a gardener or people harvesting it. So those costs are also there. But, you know, for us it's easily outweighed by the added value. Everyone should have one. And you can start on your garage with a simple sedum mat. Put down a bit of butyl pond liner and you know, edge it with something so the soil doesn't fall off, and just grow some sedum. And with that kind of weight, you know, most garage roofs can cope.
Now, I can't imagine why anybody wouldn't want this. It's just paradise on a roof, isn't it?
Yep.
What are your plans for the future of the green roof? Are you looking for funding for new projects?
I mean, our charity is about raising awareness of global issues.
Yes.
And so for us, you know, the kind of ideas embedded in the garden are an ideal way of doing that, particularly as carbon emissions, global warming is really going to have its biggest impact is going to be on the poorest communities, the most marginalised communities in various parts of the world. And so for us, raising awareness about, you know, the impact that our lifestyles has on developing countries is really important, and the garden is a good way of doing that, as well as providing some of the kind of solutions to the problem.
Problems at home,
So we're ever hopeful. We're still looking for sugar daddies, mummies who are, you know, willing to support the educational work, because at the moment the garden was designed to be low maintenance, mainly perennial forest garden, and it pretty well, you know, looks after itself. It needs a bit of time feeding it up during the autumn, and then most of the work is just about harvesting.
So that's the end of our soundseeing tour of the Risk Roof Garden in Reading. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. I need to say a very big thank you to Dave Richards for taking the time to show us round. You can check out the Risk Garden website at www.risk.org.uk/garden, and there's lots of interesting information there, including a list of the plants that they've put in the garden. The Risk Garden is open to the public on 4 weekends this year under the National Garden Scheme, and that's the 9th and 10th of June, the 7th and 8th of July, the 11th and 12th of August, and the 8th and 9th of September. And again, the details are on the website. If you're inspired to have a forest garden in your backyard, then Dave Richards runs a garden design company, and you can check out his website at www.sector39.co.uk. Thank you for listening to The Alternative Kitchen Garden. Show notes for this episode of The Alternative Kitchen Garden and links to previous episodes are available from the show website at akg.btpodshow.com. If you'd like to email me, the address is fluffymuppet@hotmail.com, and if you'd like to read my garden diary, it's available at fluffymuppet.blogspot.com, and there's also a link there to my Flickr set. See you next time on The Alternative Kitchen Garden.
The best and the brightest, served up daily by the sharpest minds in content delivery, Pod Show and Limelight.